Start by saying that I'm grateful for this opportunity to come and talk without having to actually put in a month. So thank you very much. I'll be talking about work I've done with Roderick Mosner, who's a postdoc at Princeton. It's the topic of a letter-sized item on ConMat, which will therefore be absolutely no use in following up if you wish to. So if you have to follow up, probably the best thing is to bug us long distance. So let me start by blaming Catherine, because she said that I should start by giving you an elementary introduction and saying what the problem is that we're after. So if I insult all of you, it's her doing. Okay, so what's the general question? So the general question is, what happens when you destabilize nail order? So we imagine some magnetic system with local moments, which have the dominantly antiferromagnetic component. And so the obvious guess would be that you'd get some kind of nail state. And if you manage to somehow destabilize it, perhaps by means of quantum fluctuations, if the spin happens to be small, or frustration because you have competing couplings, or it's geometric frustration, and you may end up with a state which is not nail and is in that sense disordered. So the question is, what happens then? Now, just to start by writing on a Hamiltonian, so what I have in mind is some Hamiltonian with some set of exchanges, spin operators, and technically we want, I have it teaching classical mechanics, I keep writing cross on brackets. So you have a Hamiltonian and you have a set of commutation relations, of course, then you have to specify a representation, which is to say, I have to tell you what spin I'm thinking about. Leaving that aside for a moment, so the sorts of things I said were that these JIJs will be such that the system is dominantly antiferromagnetic, but that the naive nail ordering is somehow frustrated. The problems I have in mind, I will imagine, are those for which the JIJs are such that if I think of it as a classical problem, I simply think of those as fixed length vectors and I minimize it, I'll get some unique answer. It may not be it'll be either the naive nail state or it'll be something else. So thinking of the square lattice, perhaps with first and second neighbor interactions, I might go from one nail state to something else. This is to contrast it with, let's say, something like the Kagome lattice magnet, or a highly frustrated magnet, where even the classical problem may have a very large number of ground states. Now, in fact, when you're done and you're doing the quantum theory of such systems, they actually look very similar, the disordered phases. So this is perhaps not an important distinction, but on the other hand, those are the systems that I'm going to be thinking of. In particular, since I'll be thinking on the triangular lattice, where the naive nail state is certainly present for many Hamiltonians. Okay, just to remind you that, so there's the issue of frustration. Then, of course, there's the issue of how big the spin is, because if I define the rescaled operators by just rescaling with the length of spins, these guys have the property that if I divide by S, I get an overall 1 over S, which is the familiar statement that as I go to large spin, the system looks classical and I end up with commuting variables. So at large spins, the sort of system that I'm thinking of will have some order. And the question then will be, as I come down to smaller values of spin, whether this order is somehow destabilized, and if it's destabilized, what is it replaced by? And in particular, I'll be thinking of spin 1/2. Okay, so if we think from the point of view of classical statistical mechanics, if we take something like a nail ordered state and we destabilize it by thermal fluctuations, we go to a paramagnetic state. And the cartoon of the paramagnet is that I have individual spins which are essentially uncorrelated. So it's a state that's described as correlation, has no correlations because you have basically independent spins. So you might think to yourself that if you destabilize a nail state, that what you're going to get to is some quantum version of that, a quantum paramagnet. And indeed, if you give the natural signal model description of the nail state, which is, let's say, an O3 nonlinear signal model, and you disorder that, the putative state that that describes is a quantum paramagnet. That's what happens if the fluctuations get to be too big. Now, in 72 and 73, in a couple of papers, Anderson and then Fizikas and Anderson, suggested sort of another alternative for what might happen when you destabilize the nail state, and that's the so-called resonating valence bond state. So let me build up to that. So if I take just the problem of two spins, then the solution to that, and if I have an antiferromagnetic bond connecting them, is the singlet wave function you all know and love. And that's what I'm going to call following Pauling and Anderson a valence bond. So if you imagine that you somehow managed to get rid of the possibility of long range order among the spins, then if you look locally in the energetics, a particularly sensible thing to do is to try and make singlets between spins, right? And so you might imagine that the destruction of nail order is followed by passage to a phase where valence bond configurations dominate. So what I want to do is I want to take, so let me just draw pictures for the square lattice. Right. What I'll do is I'll connect them somehow. That will be an example of a valence bond configuration. But you see immediately the problem, which is that there isn't one valence bond configuration. There are lots of valence bond configurations. In particular, this is exactly geometrically a hardcore dimer covering of this lattice, the square lattice. And you can count hardcore dimer coverings. And on the square lattice, for example, and on the triangular lattice, the number of such coverings grows exponentially with the volume. It's a macroscopic degeneracy. It corresponds in the thermodynamic limit to a finite entropy per site. So whereas it would be good to make valence bonds, there are lots of ways of doing it. And indeed, in a sense, this is a frustrated problem even within the valence bond manifold, because a given spin can form a valence bond with any of its neighbors, but it's forced to choose one of them. And so it's frustrated because it can't do everything that it would like to do. Now, given valence, so let me just imagine that I somehow managed to end up in a valence bond dominated manifold. But the Hamiltonian will still move the system between different valence bond configurations. And so it means that even in the valence bond manifold, there's a non-trivial problem to be solved, which is the problem of resonance. Right. So in particular, if you focus on something like this, the sort of thing you can do is under the action of the Hamiltonian, this thing can move to something like that. And this is the analog of resonance in benzene. A classic textbook example, which I always get wrong when I try and draw it. Let's see if I succeed. Something like that. Right. So it's that kind of move. And so the notion put forward by, this goes back to Pauling, but then in this context by Anderson and Fizikas, was that under the influence of such resonance moves, you could have a situation where the system would basically be spread over all configurations of this kind, roughly speaking, with equal weight, and you would have a resonating valence bond state. Okay. So I just wanted, at that point, this is what they said, I just want to distinguish two parts of the program. So part one of the program is you take a nail system which starts with a nail state, you frustrate it somehow, so it ends up not having a nail state, but being dominated by valence bond configurations. But even if you've accomplished that, you're still left with the problem of deciding what happens within the valence bond manifold. Namely, do resonance processes actually give you a liquid of dimers, or do they somehow give you a crystal? And if they give you a crystal, you haven't managed to find the resonating valence bond state. You found a crystal of valence bonds. Now, why is a liquid of valence bonds something good to have? In the context of this workshop, I think the obvious answer is that such a liquid naturally gives you a way to get fractionalized quasi-particles. So the sort of standard picture is, imagine that you've got a liquid of valence bonds, and I take a particular bond and I break it into its two constituent spins. If the surrounding system is a liquid, I can pull them apart, ending up with a picture where I've got these two spins far away, at that point it doesn't really matter what their relative orientation is. And in between, forgetting about the lattice for a moment, pictorially you've got a liquid of dimers. So in such a state, I would expect that I can have independent spin 1/2 degrees of freedom living far from each other. And then if I look locally, there's my spin on. An object has spin 1/2 relative to its background and is neutral because, of course, I still have one electron per site. Furthermore, I could go in here and knock this guy out. If I do, I get the holon, introduced in this context by Steve Kivelson and collaborators right here. And so not only do I get spin-ons as excitations, I also get these holons. And in particular, if I then ask the question, the sort of question which Senthil and Fisher focused attention on recently, namely, even in an insulator, if I go in and knock out an electron, what happens? Well, that knocked out electron can then decay into a spin-on and a holon. And so if I can show that these guys can separate, then I've shown that it's an insulator whose excited spectrum, although there'll be a gap because I'll have to break a valence bond by hypothesis, will be characterized by spin charge separation. Okay. So if I can find a liquid phase, I found a fractionalized insulator. I'm not sure how many stars I'm supposed to attach to that in the Senthil Fisher classification, but
but then this framework, could you comment on what if I have a two-leg ladder half-filled? Is that a valence bond solid in your picture then, or is that a valence bond liquid, or where does that fall in?
Actually, I don't remember what that one does, but I seem to remember a recent paper. I don't remember the answer to what...
It's a quantum paramagnet. It's neither of those.
The two-leg ladder?
It's a valence bond solid?
No, because it doesn't break symmetry.
It's already broken.
Yeah, so it's a quantum paramagnet in the sense that Shibachi described. It's what you get if you disorder the nonlinear signal model. It's got spin one, massive spin one excitations. So it doesn't have any broken symmetry and it doesn't have any fractionalization.
Yeah, I know. I agree. It doesn't have fractionalization. I thought of it as a spin liquid, but it's not.
No, it's by the definition Shibachi gave, it's a quantum paramagnet.
I'd rather settle for it as a solid thing.
No, it doesn't break symmetry.
The dimer model on a ladder like that, of course, has columnar order, and I think that's the sense in which you're referring to it as a solid. Steve's pointing out that yes, but the only translations you have are along the axis; those are not affected, and then the only excitation has been one. So I think this is a case where you could.
You're telling us if you could find a 2D dimer. Spin liquid,
right?
It would fractionalize. It is.
Right. Oh, wait, I'm sorry. I know you said it, but how do I know that? I mean, or is that going to be your?
Well, that's something I'll also show in more detail. But I'm saying intuitively, the this is by way of advertising the appeal that if this was a liquid state, you can plausibly believe that separating the two members of the pair will not.
You could also believe that you can't separate them. Really.
Right. So but I'll, and in fact. Okay. It's something to be decided by computation, which we can do.
Okay.
Going to, or could you say I'm pretty sure about the extent of the overcompletion?
Yes. Okay. So actually, let me come back to that. Let me come back to that. All valence bond states are overcomplete, but nearest neighbor ones are not. In fact, for some lattices, there are proofs of linear independence due to Chase-Jones and Kippelson. Since many of you have drinks, if you like, I don't particularly mean to do this because he is my thesis advisor. It's not a good idea to praise him in public, but you can play a version of Hi Bob every time I mention Steve Kivelson. You can, you know, sort of take a swing. So, maybe every time Steve jumps in, you can take two. But the point is that I'll be following on work that in the short range RVB physics that was done when I was a graduate student, 87, 88, and Steve was one of the leaders in it, so inevitably I'll end up referring to him repeatedly. Okay. Good. All right, so that was to say that an RVB phase would be good to have. Okay, now let me make a caveat. When I'm drawing these pictures, I'm thinking really of short-range valence bonds. In fact, I'll think of nearest neighbor valence bonds as sort of an extreme strong coupling version of the state. There is, of course, the long-range RVB state, also invented by Anderson, which was an attempt to generalize the one-dimensional solution of the nearest neighbor Heisenberg chain, which also has the interpretation as valence bonds of arbitrary length with some distribution. And that is not really done, as far as I can tell, ever in terms of wave functions, but really in terms of gauge theory treatments, pioneered again by, I think, Bastian and Anderson, but continued by people such as Patrick Lee, who are in the audience. And that is not what I'll be talking about, because that's a phase that's putatively perhaps characterized by gapless spin-ons, at least in Phil's version. And what I'll be talking about, a spin-on will necessarily be gap, because I have to break a valence bond in the first place. Okay. Let me digress for a moment and talk about the simplest valence bond problem, which is in one dimension. Right. So, let me say one thing at the start so that you're not disappointed at the end. I really should have said an RVB phase in the triangular lattice quantum dimer model. The reason being that in the program that I outlined, you have to first figure out how to get to the valence bond manifold. And if you have a Hamiltonian which is dominated by that, then there's the resonance problem. I will not solve for you today the first part of it, which is how to get a Hamiltonian which is dominated by the valence bond manifold, although I know of at least one example where on the triangular lattice valence bonds dominate. I will, however, solve for you the second part, which is to show you that the resonance problem doesn't prevent you from getting an RVP phase. So just to be clear about it. Okay, back to one dimension. So one dimension is particularly easy in terms of valence bonds. You've got just two states, that one and that one, if you like phase A and phase B, because they're just translates of each other. There is a Hamiltonian, the Majumdar-Ghosh model, with first and second neighbor couplings with J2 equals a half J1, if I remember right, for which these two are exact ground states. Of course, no resonance is possible. There is no local move that you can make in the valence bond manifold. So these are valence bond solids. But the peculiar thing is, of course, as in one dimension always, that you can still get spin-ons. And the reason being that you can make solitons. So you have that guy, you put a spin, you do that. And of course, you would have done that. And so you see that I've gone from phase A to phase B, but this guy is then free to move around. Or if I broke a pair and I moved them apart, I would just create the opposite phase in between them, but there would be no confining energy as I tried to move them apart. So one dimension, even in the valence bond language, gives you spin-ons, holons, spin charge separation. No surprise, because this is just polyacetylene physics with one set of bonds removed instead of having single and double bonds, and that again is in the celebrated case of polyacetylene, is where many of these ideas actually began. Yeah?
There's something, on principle, you wonder. I mean, in one dimension, you have a special situation because you have these two ground states, you have only half as many spin-on orbitals as you have sides, because if you start with one state, put in the domain wall, side A has to end up with a full link, right? But if you start with state A on the left, you can only put your spin on the area, you have only half as many ways to put your spin on than you have sides. Mm-hmm. Because, you must have an integer number of dimers before you get to the first.
Right.
So you actually, in a sense, you have only half as many spin-on orbitals as you have sides. Mm-hmm. But in two dimensions, this restriction would seem to evaporate. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, is that something which bothers you?
Certainly doesn't bother me, but whether it's something that I should reflect on is something we can talk about later. I think the point I wanted to make here was that one dimension is peculiar in the sense, and this will have, when I come to the gauge theory connection, that the gauge theory description of this problem still gives you deconfined spin-ons in one dimension, but by a different mechanism than it does in higher dimensions. So in a sense, there is an Ising gauge theory description that does everything. That's basically the point I wanted to try and make here. Okay, so let's move to dimensions greater than one, in particular two, and we'll just stop there. Okay, so now we need something more. We need a liquid of dimers. So as I said, there's a resonance problem, and I have two options. I can get a liquid, which is what I'd like, or I can get a crystal. The reason I would get a crystal is a phenomenon first noted by Villain, which is order by disorder. And so therefore, contrast, if I get a liquid, I'm going to call that disorder by disorder. So first, the logic of that. The logic of that is that this set of dimer coverings, valence bond states, there were lots of them, right? So at some level, before I put in the resonance processes, I had lots of states. It was very disordered in that sense. But the quantum mechanics lift the degeneracy, as it almost generically must, but it does so in a fashion that the wave function is kind of localized all over the place. So it's somehow the quantum state inherits the disorder of the parent classical manifold as best it could, and that's disorder by disorder. So in fact, if you go back to Anderson and Fizikas, that's exactly what they were hoping. The fact that there was an Ising magnet which was disordered would somehow continue into an RVB case. Order by disorder is, of course, the bane of RVB theories of this kind. And this is what kills the state on the square lattice. And that happens for the following sort of reason. So imagine for a moment that I think of these configurations, the different dimer configurations, as points in some multidimensional space. So in this case, I've got sort of some set of points. And by resonance, I sort of move between them in some fashion. But there's no particular difference in the connectivity. I can kind of get from things to things. In such a case, if you think it's just a hopping problem on some generalized lattice, and the wave function will sort of be all over the place. But by contrast, I could have a situation where I have one particular state from which I can connect to lots of things. And then somehow, as I go further in the tree, I have fewer things to connect to. Right? In such a situation, the kinetic energy actually does best of this motion in this configuration space when I'm at the spot with highest connectivity. Because although there are the greatest number of ways of leaving it, in fact, in the quantum mechanics, that's where you get stuck, because it's easiest to act in that state. You just have to do some trees and do hopping problems on it to convince yourself of that. And that's order by disorder. You get stuck in the state that had, in fact, the greatest number of moving parts, things that you could, and I'll come back to a more detailed example of this. And so this, in quantum mechanics, this order by disorder phenomenon takes this form. And when it does, you can end up being stuck near the state. That state will typically be ordered, because an ordered state will have the regularity needed to have a large number of ways to leave it. And so you'll get some order that you weren't bargaining for. Okay. So that's the sort of thing we don't want to have, because that kills the possibility of getting a liquid. I should say that some of these themes are rather nicely illustrated in a family of transfers, frustrated transverse field Ising models that Roderick Mosner, Premichandra, and I studied. And since this is not costing anybody advertising time, I hope you won't mind if I just note that you could look up our paper to see multiple examples of this sort of stuff illustrated in the context of the simplest models of frustrated systems with quantum dynamics. In fact, they're intimately connected to this, as I'll come back. Good. All right. So now I want to do the resonance problem. To do that, I'm going to use quantum dimer models, which were invented by Steve Kivelson and Dan Roxar. Time to take a swig there. Okay. So this comes back to the question of which Steve Gerwin raised. Valence bond states have the somewhat annoying property that, let's say if we take nearest neighbor valence bond states, that they're not all orthogonal. So in particular, this and this have a non-zero overlap. Okay. So it's sort of annoying to work in spaces in which the basis elements are linearly independent, but not orthogonal. So what Steve and Dan suggested was that one imagined a process of orthogonalization. So I take a valence bond configuration, which can be given an explicit form in terms of spins, but I imagine constructing from it by orthogonalizing a dimer state. So pictorially, it looks exactly the same, but in fact, it's some superposition of valence bond states in which the parent valence bond state has a large amplitude, but the other things have to be mixed in order to make sure that the states are orthogonal. Now, so whereas two valence bond states will not be orthogonal, by contrast, the dimer states descended from those will be orthogonal. Okay. Now, of course, you have to find a way of doing that, and they invented an expansion, the overlap expansion. Because when you calculate the overlaps of valence bond states, you find that you get something like 1 over root 2 to the length of certain loops coming from transition graphs in which you overlay them. 1 over root 2 is a recognizably small number, but one which can be made even smaller by the process of calling it x. And so that x then becomes x then becomes the parameter. And in this fashion, you can then generate a controlled expansion in which the valence bond states are orthogonalized order by order in this expansion.
So this is because they're undercomplete.
Yeah. Right. That's right.
They are undercomplete.
Yeah. Nearest neighbor valence bond states are undercomplete. All possible valence bond states. Two drinks coming up. Yeah.
Yeah. Risking getting
Please.
Everybody drunk here.
Yeah.
I mean, the issue, once they're linearly independent, there's no question that you can orthogonalize them.
Right.
The only question is when you orthogonalize them, do they bear any?
I was just about to say that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Saved you one drink there. I'll say it myself. Right. So as Steve said precisely, if it's a good expansion, right, then in some sense you've added to the parent valence bond configuration not too much of everything else, so that then it's a good thing to do. In particular, the way this will show up is that as I do this transformation, I have to then transform the Hamiltonian that I had in spin language to begin with. That Hamiltonian will now involve various processes, so for example resonance processes like this. And if the expansion isn't good, you'll find that the resulting Hamiltonian has, with coefficients of order 1, loops, resonance loops of arbitrarily long length. If it's a good expansion, then, of course, it'll only have a few of them. So there's evidence based on...
Also, what is the overlap between the dimer state and apparent state as well? Some number.
Yeah, right, because it's got the parent valence bond state as a major component.
No, it'll be zero in the thermodynamic limit. Well, it's got
to be. Well, yeah, because it'll have, let's say, just local resonance loops spread over the area.
That doesn't matter. I think the question is the overlap per unit
volume
or something.
Right.
Like that.
No, but it's actually zero. I mean, it could converge rapidly.
No. In all cases, it's zero.
I think even if you just independently note that you're going to be able to do these plaquette flips all over the volume, that probably already gives you zero. Okay.
But the Hamiltonian, of course, isn't diagonal in this place. It's not acting on one of the state or the orthogonal relabeling. It takes you to other states.
Yeah.
What states does it take you to?
I will write down the Hamiltonian. Yeah. So you imagine orthogonalizing the valence bond states. There's a prescription for doing it. You take the overlap matrix, you take the square root of the overlap matrix, and for example, you could take various prescriptions, but there's a Lodian method which is symmetric and treats the states more or less the same way. So for a finite size system.
So for valence bond state after our states where you have formed dimers among nearest.
Right. And you've written them in terms of spins. Now, these states are not orthogonal.
Right.
So you orthogonalize them.
Yeah.
And as you do, you keep track of, as you do that in this expansion parameter, you can track a given valence bond state evolving into what I'm going to call a dimer state. But that dimer state will be labeled by the pattern of the valence bond state. By this pattern, this picture.
Okay.
Because what I'll say is the state which looks like this, if I just do this, is the one that in the orthogonalization procedure evolved from the valence bond state, which was literally this with these being singlets. But once I've orthogonalized, I've had to add into it other configurations in which, of course, I've had to do resonance processes on this. And the notion is that in this overlap expansion, this is a well-controlled procedure, so that the labeling of the dimer state by the parent valence bond state is actually sensible.
Okay, and said it's uncomplete in the end.
Well, no, then that is my Hilbert space. I'm only working in the space of these states.
These are linearly independent.
These are linearly independent.
I'll label them.
Right.
Okay, but they do not label the Hilbert space. I mean, they are only a small
fraction of the total singlet manifold, for example. Right, right. So by assumption, we are dominated by valence bond states. Right. Right. Good. So if I carry through this procedure, and the details, as I said, are things we can discuss in this overlap expansion, what I'm going to get is some quantum dimer model. And the simplest terms that I can get in that are the ones that I'm going to look at. So for example, for the square lattice, let me write down.
Now you're going to write down Hamiltonian in the subspace, right?
A Hamiltonian in the subspace of valence bond states written in the basis of these orthogonalized dimer.
I was asking before you do that, what you're throwing away, which is also...
Right. So what I've thrown away are...
I know what you're throwing away. The question is, what kind of states have you thrown away? So is the Hamiltonian acting on the original basis, or the orthogonalized basis?
Right.
takes you outside this subspace.
Correct.
Well,
correct.
What does it take you to?
It will generate, for instance, some longer length valence bonds. Look, it will preserve the singlet character because that's just a good quantum number. If I take all valence bond states, namely of arbitrary length, then that's an overcomplete set. And so,
is there a known minimal complete set?
Not to my knowledge.
So this introduces state with higher energy. Can you estimate what that energy is? Doesn't it introduce states with higher energy components?
Well, look, since I'm not doing an actual Hamiltonian for
he's
you.
He's assuming that this Hamiltonian is such
that it's just a Hamiltonian.
Right.
So which is what you're going to do? You're going to...
For example, on the square lattice. Right. For example, I missed the joke, but let me carry on anyway.
It's a Hamiltonian free theory.
It's a Hamiltonian free theory, right.
But it's not content free, though.
It's not content free.
Well, so hard to hope.
In particular, just as a way of justifying it ahead of time, on the square lattice, there are direct microscopic studies of the J1, J2 model. Mm-hmm. First neighbor coupling, second neighbor anti-ferromagnetic coupling. When you destabilize nail order, you actually see these spin pyral states, valence bond states, and those are exactly the ones that you would predict starting from the quantum dimer model. So if you like, the quantum dimer model in the square lattice is the effective theory of the J1, J2 model for J2 bigger than whatever it takes to leave the nail phase, the number which I forget.
So there are cases in which this procedure gives you the...
Indeed. On the square lattice, it actually works beautifully, much to the chagrin of its creators because they wanted a liquid phase which it doesn't predict, but it works beautifully. Okay. So let me write Hamiltonian in the dimer subspace, the quantum dimer Hamiltonian. So I'll write it as a kinetic energy operator plus a potential energy operator as the simplest things that I can write down. The kinetic energy operator is something that just does the simplest move plus its immersion conjugate. And the simplest potential energy that I can write down is something that just counts the number of, let's say, plaquettes with parallel bonds. There's no point in counting the total, the number of bonds. That's always the same. One more thing I should probably mention is that this piece can be derived for SUN magnets on the square lattice, particular SUN magnets, particular representations, at order 1 over n, and this was done by Reed and Sestave, you get only the kinetic energy term. More generally, as far as these things are concerned, what you want to do is have loops of dimers, for instance, like that, so that you can slide them around. You see that that's the most easiest way of just staying
this
within.
Is if you mean for an SUN spin or something?
Right, so what I will do is I'll have
a dimer, you mean another singlet?
There's a definition of a singlet generalized to that, right. Right.
And you don't get a dimer?
If I take the nearest neighbor Heisenberg, if I generalize the nearest neighbor Heisenberg model to SUN spins, so I put one representation in one sublattice, the conjugate in the other, so I can have singlets, then at order 1 over n. And also you have to take a particular, it's a particular representation there, so on and so forth. There's a way of getting at it. It's nice. I'm not sure you want to be necessarily more impressed by that than an overlap expansion. Different ways.
Can I understand that? But just saying that this small number 1 over root 2, SU2 becomes 1 over root 10 for SUN.
Well, in SUN, maybe.
Okay.
Maybe. Is that right? I mean, there's a particular representation. I've never thought through the full...
Yeah, that's what Sudhir
said.
Yeah.
The full lap expansion becomes bigger.
No, I guess that's probably... Yeah.
Shivaji, I'm confused about the Hamiltonian.
Right.
Suppose back in that picture that you have over there, when I have the two vertical bars,
right,
and then I go to a horizontal bar,
right,
and on top of the horizontal bar, I have another two vertical bars,
right,
on top of that.
Here?
Right. Two vertical. Then what happens when this Hamiltonian...
Oh, sorry. So this is... let me put this on plaquettes, and it's a sum over plaquettes.
So what happens when it's acting on the plaquette?
So it'll give me, acting on this, there'll be, this plaquette term will give me this.
But what about
next one?
And then there'll be another one there.
Just the next one up.
Right. On this three nothing lines.
It kills it.
It kills it. So I see. It just kills it.
It just kills it. Because I've kept the...
Okay.
So this is the shortest range stuff that I can write down. And this is what I'd like to study. Okay, so now we can ask the question, does this Hamiltonian possess a resonating valence bond phase? And the answer to that is no. On the square lattice. So let me start sketching a phase diagram. So since I only have basically one ratio of parameters, some ratio V over T, and I can add, if you like, a temperature. Now the first observation that I want to make is that let me go in this problem to infinite temperature. Normally that's not a particularly intelligent thing to do. But in this case, since the Hilbert space is constrained, there's still non-trivial stuff left at infinite temperature. So at infinite temperature, I simply sum over all dimer configurations, and I can, for instance, calculate a dimer-dimer correlation function in that problem. That's a classical dimer problem, well studied long ago, and the answer there is that the dimer-dimer correlation function is in fact critical, which is to say, if you look, for example, at the number of horizontal dimers at some place and the number of horizontal dimers at some distance x, it sort of course, must have an expectation value, but then the corrections are algebraic. So what you discover is that at infinite temperature, there is a sense in which the dimer model is critical. So of course, if you come down in temperature, it suggests very strongly that you'll order almost anywhere, since you were critical already at infinite temperature.
Did you say that this model was solved exactly by Akimusen?
No.
It's a difficult model to solve.
This is a difficult model. That's correct. There is a solution advertised in the literature when there's only T by Peter Orland, but it's believed by many people, myself included, for different various reasons that that's wrong. There's just technical errors
with only the T term. And right. That's by who? Orland?
Peter Orland. Mapping to some fermionic strings, the sort of thing that should please make David pick up his ears. Okay. What we do know, however, you say, is the model exactly soluble? Well, actually, it is exactly soluble in some places. For instance, if, let's say, this point is 1, if I go to the right of 1, this was shown already by Roxar and Kevelson, that you have exact zero-energy states, which are the ground states, which are basically these sorts of staggered states, which have no flippable plaquettes whatsoever. So to the right of this, you don't like to have parallel bonds, thanks to this term. And the kinetic energy can't overcome them, and that you can show by just finding a bound that that's the exact ground state. Actually, it turns out there are some more with domain walls built in, but that's basically it. At this point, namely 1, value of this ratio, there is we call the Roxar-Kevelson state, just the sum over configurations, all configurations with equal amplitude. And this was the thing, of course, that got them all excited, because this would be the prototypical RVB state. You could hardly do better than just sum over everybody with equal amplitude. The problem with that, of course, is that that's a quantum wave function which has exactly the same diagonal correlators as the classical dimer problem, equal weight. So again, the dimer-dimer correlation function is algebraic. So really what you found is a critical point. What's strange is that in some sense, immediately to the right of it, it looks like you have a first-order transition. And so that's kind of confusing. It's not clear whether this should continue or not. But really, the state itself looks critical. What we now believe from various sources, most particularly mappings to quantum height models, which are discussed by various people, Radkin-Kivelson, Sabir Sachdev, Leonid Levithov, that everywhere to the left of this, I get columnar order, roughly speaking. So if I go way off to the left, I can set the kinetic energy to 0. If the coefficient of this is negative, then of course I'd like to have as many parallel, like flippable plaquettes as possible. So that's clearly the answer off at minus infinity. What's less obvious is that after you pass the point 0, when you're no longer favoring it on the grounds of potential energy, that you still have this kind of order. This is where the business of order by disorder comes in. You still select something like this because that's the maximum number of places for the kinetic energy operator to act. There is a question of whether you go from this to something called the Plaquette state, in which instead of, which somehow breaks further the symmetry of the configuration, but in the language of height representations, that's sort of a minor point. So let's leave that aside. You break translation symmetry everywhere to the left of this point. Okay. presumably there's a kind of a critical RVB phase, which goes up from here, because we know that at infinite temperature, this certainly connects up to that. And that's then presumably the full phase diagram of the quantum timer model.
Let's see, you said that at zero, some guy had an exact solution.
Right.
That's consistent with this picture?
No. Well, no, because he found a gapless spectrum.
Some guy was named, I think,
Orland. Peter Orland.
Not Andy Orland.
No, Peter. There's some suggestion that going between the columnar state and the Plaquette state could give you some low energy degrees of freedom at that point, based on numerics that Roderick Mostner and myself have done. But this is somehow a side issue. I don't think that has anything to do with the gapless excitations that Orland was talking about.
Didn't you look on a finite size system where his exact solution...
His exact solution is wrong because mappings don't work, and you know, they're talking about... His solution is wrong, but I'm saying there might be gapless excitations for completely different reasons. But Orland is wrong. I would put money on that. Okay.
So on that wedge, you do have an RVB.
You have this critical liquid. Okay. But yeah, you do in that sense. Now, one thing I should say, I was advertising earlier that in the studies of the J1, J2 model, in fact, you see evidence for both these sorts of phases. And that's what you see when you frustrate the nail lattice. So the quantum grammar model, in that sense, does just fine. It tells you what you ought to see when you frustrate the nail order. And you're in a valence bond phase.
Can I ask a trivial question? Why is this more convenient? I mean, what you're really saying is that this is the right low energy effective theory for some. Why is it good to cast the low energy effective theory as a Hamiltonian, which includes many also high energy states that you're not interested in, rather than trying to write down a field theory or an effective action or something? I mean, just why is this a better thing to do?
Well, ultimately, I'll write it as a gauge theory.
Okay.
Six of one, half a dozen of the other. Okay. I mean, it's a gauge theory. It's constrained. So anything that's constrained, I don't think there's, you know, you have to deal with the constraint somehow. So you can write it as a gauge theory. It doesn't actually help you solve it.
Okay.
Probably helps you sell it. as I've discovered, I didn't tell it was a gauge theory at the start. Right. Okay. All right. Spinons. So, as I said at the start, in this problem and in this way of looking at it, spinons are, you know, things where I've sort of unpaired spins. Of course, removing them gives me a holon. There's really not a distinction between holons and spinons. So I'm going to ask the static confinement question, much as one does for quarks in a pure gauge theory. I'll have two holes, two places where I've removed electrons, keep them fixed by hand, and ask what's the energy of the state as a function of separation. It's in principle a distinct question from that of dynamics, but let's leave that aside. Okay. At this point, it turns out that you can write down wave functions with two holons localized in arbitrary, or two spinons localized in arbitrary distance apart, which are exactly degenerate. So you pay the creation energy of the spinons, but then there's nothing else. So the spinons at this point are actually non-interacting. I mean, they're not confined. They just have no interaction whatsoever. Immediately to the left, I have a crystalline phase. And in something like this, for example, if I was trying to make spinons, I would end up with a long string, which was out of whack. Right? So I would have a linear confinement. And similarly, in this phase, I would have a confinement. So this point is actually rather nice. You have confined spinons to the left and confined spinons to the right, but their confinement weakens, vanishes exactly at that point, and then picks up again. From the left, it'll vanish continuously, but of course, the right, it'll jump discontinuously. That point has a mixed character, which actually can be understood very nicely in this height representation that I'm not doing. You can actually write an action in which you see that the mixed critical first-order character just comes from something going negative, and so discuss that with you later if you're interested. But from the left, it certainly continues. Okay.
Another say this is a gauge theory. In two dimensions, the gauge theory would be logarithmically confining, right?
But let's come back.
Confining?
Well, in a crystalline phase, which you probably wouldn't normally consider in what you're used to, translation symmetry breaking phase,
I see.
You can end up being the
gauge. Well, because translation invariances.
Right. Since you brought up logarithms, let me mention a case of an interesting logarithm here. Let me go to infinite temperature and play the same game and compute the free energy. This is another calculation which is in the literature. It was done by Stevenson and Daniel Fisher's father. You're not related to them. And they found this. And they, in this beautiful computation, they showed that in fact the free energy cost grows logarithmically with distance. So it's a very peculiar result. In this model, if you like, the spin-on confinement question gives you logarithmic confinement at high temperatures and no confinement at zero temperature if you track through that RVV phase. Altogether bizarre. It's an entropic effect. Mostly it should convince you that you don't want to be in that RVV phase because it makes no sense. but this is these are both exact. Well, then presumably, I don't know for a fact, but I imagine that it sort of continues on down. It's certainly true at infinite temperature, but I can't promise you that it doesn't go away.
It's got to be true at all finite.
You would.
It's got to be true at all finite.
So the coefficient of logarithm design
is just 15 or one of those.
Probably.
But aren't there people doing high temperature expansion? Can these people answer the question?
This is again, this is a dimer. The Hilbert space at infinite temperature here is constrained. It's non-trivial. High temperature expansions rely on the fact that the infinite temperature problem is trivial. So it's
oh,
not.
Oh, I see.
Yeah,
I see.
This is a non-trivial. The reason we're getting interesting answers at infinite temperature is because the constraint builds in a very large energy scale. It's
oh,
not
I
really
see.
Infinite temperature. It's really.
Okay.
So that makes it tough. Yeah. Okay. So having discussed the square lattice case, let me now move to the triangular lattice. Okay. Now, following similar reasoning, I will write down a quantum dimer model on the triangular lattice. It will look very similar. The only difference is that, let's say, the kinetic energy. Okay, so the triangular lattice, as you well know, has a typical neighborhood that looks like that. Again, I'm going to make valence bonds. And so you can see that the minimum move that I can make actually will again be a Paquette move. Right? And so the kinetic energy operator will look like, for instance, this goes to that, probably not drawing that right, plus two more rotated versions, not to mention Hermitian conjugation. So that's it. And then there's a potential energy operator, which will simply count these guys and the rotated versions. And that's it. And then I will bring them in with coefficients T and V as before. Now, the crucial observation for us was noting that the classical dimer problem on the triangular lattice is in fact disordered. On the square lattice, it was critical. In fact, on the hexagonal lattice, it's critical, which were the examples that everybody, I think, knew about when they were thinking about them. But on the triangular lattice, which is not in the literature, the answer is disordered. So this is something you can solve by standard Pfaffian techniques, going back to Castellan, except you do them using Grassmann's, following Stuart Samuel, and you find that the dimer-dimer correlation function is not that, but it's that plus something exponential.
You said classical. By classical, you mean high infinite temperature.
Infinite temperature. So I just classical in this case means I simply sum. I do a classical sum with all configurations weighted equally.
Okay.
So the triangular lattice classical dimer model is fundamentally different. In fact, the correlation length is extremely short. I mean, it's like lattice constant, basically.
David just asked me a question that I can't answer.
Yeah.
Did you need honeycomb lattice?
It's not clear that's my problem, since he's your employer.
What's the
hexagonal lattice and the square lattice are both bipartite.
Do
you mean honeycomb?
I mean honeycomb, which... this is one of these changing... I think these... Yeah, historically, the triangular lattice was sometimes called hexagonal, but I mean, these days...
Oh, you drew a hexagon.
No, but this is not... This is... Yeah. Right.
And there's a point in the middle.
Good. Sorry.
David said he doesn't get it. He's still asking.
Hexagons have no lattice point in the geometric
sense. No idea you had the permanent self so terrorized since you took
it. Exactly. He's always asking.
I thought it was just the assistant professors at Princeton. Okay. Having made two major enemies in the audience, let's see if I get out of line.
See, you're still an assistant professor.
That speaks volumes for my courage. Yeah, I think it's courage and courage star. Courage is fractionalized from intellect, then. Okay, back to the triangular lattice. Okay, so I have this Hamiltonian, basically just that thing with the same parameters. So what I'm just going to do is take this picture and start redrawing it. Now, let me just draw it separately. So the first point I made was that as I go off to infinite temperature, I have now, at T equals infinity, a liquid. So if you like, I've already found a good RVB phase, because this infinite temperature really means temperatures which are low compared to going out of the valence bond manifold. So if I had such a system with widely separated scales, as I went down in temperature, there would come a low temperature at which the thing would look like an RVB state. The other thing is, okay, now let me come down. Off to the right, there's again a staggered phase, one in which nothing is flippable. It looks like that. Turns out now it's the unique state that you can write down. On the square lattice, they were actually order L for an L by L system. This point, something peculiar to these dimer models, again is an RK point at 1 with a state, which is then exactly, again, the sum over configurations of the equal amplitude, which is wonderful because there's a genuine RVB state, because now the correlations are short-ranged, so the diagonal correlations in this state are short-ranged. The problem is, of course, that this thing sits on the what looks again like the verge of a first-order transition, and so you have to worry that this is somehow non-generic. One thing you can do to make progress is to ask yourself what you think the excitation spectrum at such a state is. In the case of the square lattice, one of the things, again, which was evidence that this was a critical point, was that Roxar and Kibbleson found that there was a family of gapless excitations at this point, things they dubbed resonons. The same argument that they went through, which is a single mode approximation calculation, and so when it succeeds, it's good, but when it doesn't, you can doubt it, nevertheless shows you here that there are no gapless excitations. So we have every reason to think that the spectrum here, within the dimer manifold, is gapped. Now I have a disordered state with a gap, and I think most of you would bet that that should be connected to a phase. Nevertheless, since the matter is delicate, we've done a simulation, results of which I can show you in just a minute, which give us compelling evidence that as we move off to the left from here, you know, we can probably go maybe all the way to 1, but certainly, you know, 2/3 and beyond, there's no question that you get an RVB phase, in which the dimer correlations are extremely short-ranged.
What's the picture for these resonons?
The resonons are that you take large loops, and then in the sum that you're doing, you have a phase factor that has to do with the size of the loops and things like that. There's a gauge version of them that Matthew Hastings was trying to explain to me by phone, which I haven't totally digested. Way off to the left, actually, extremely.
Why are you going down to zero?
Ah, thank you. Excellent point. Especially as this will be on the net, which confused the hell out of people like me who look at these things from the net. Okay. If I go off way to the left, where I only have the potential energy, then this problem is again different a little bit than the square lattice, because in fact, instead of having that unique columnar state, I actually again have a very large number of states. It turns out they're equal in numbers, you know, they're again order e to the L, e to the square root of the volume. But then you start putting in the kinetic energy, and to sixth order in perturbation theory, you find that in fact you again pick out a columnar state, except that since it's a triangular lattice, it goes out that way. Right? So it's again an order by disorder effect, because, you know, at some order in perturbation theory, you can do more things to this state than you could do to any other. So off here, there's a columnar state.
But the sixth order term is the first one that just left.
That distinguished. Well, at fourth order, you lose a bunch, and at sixth order, then you're unique. Yeah. Yeah, it's not sixth order. this point has evidence of a more complicated ordering pattern. Root 12 by root 12 is what we call it, based on similar misnomers elsewhere. It has a 12-side unit cell. I won't bet that it's there, but if it goes away, it goes away in favor of the liquid. So for the purposes of this talk, you shouldn't worry. So then, you know, presumably what happens is that I've got some phase like that, which in our VB phase starts at infinite temperature and actually makes it down all the way over a finite range of parameters. Good. Yeah. So maybe this is a good point to which to show you the numerical evidence for which one transparency. So what are we looking at here? Focus first on the on the left-hand side. So we're sitting at a temperature which in units of T is the lowest of those. It's about that, 0.033, so pretty much as low as we can get. These are different values of the ratio of V over T, going from 0.11, sorry, that's gone, but let's look here. So basically, remember that the RVB phase and the triangular lattice in this region, so we're sort of going from about here, you know, next to this, to 0.95, which is fairly close to the Roxar-Kivelson point. First thing you want to notice is that dominantly, so these are dimer correlation, yeah.
What are you plotting?
What am I plotting? Dimer correlation, a dimer like this, translated along the x-axis, say, parallel to itself. And I'm plotting that dimer correlation function, Fourier transform, so this is 0 and pi, which we should have labeled. This was done in a hurry. So this is in momentum space. The fact that it's very broad shows you that it's very short range in real space. The classical, sorry?
The connected part.
Yeah, because the yeah, right, the connected part.
And where's 1 on the
answer? Well, the point I want to make is the comparison to the classical answer, which I know analytically. So the classical answer are these crosses, the infinite temperature answer. Infinite temperature answer is the crosses. Mm-hmm. And you can see that there's, the first thing you want to notice is it pretty much looks the same as at infinite temperature, right? In more detail, you can see that as I start at 0.95, you know, which is red, what that turns out is there are discretization errors in the Monte Carlo because we're using, you know, time. That's not actually the best curve you can get. But if you look beyond that, let's say at 0.86, it pretty much lies on top of that. You start getting into trouble only as you get into these last two curves around 0.38 and 0.11, where you begin to see this feature pop out. That's actually evidence of this root 12 by root 12 phase that I mentioned. It's at a particular wave vector, which is characteristic of that. But until that point, at the lowest temperatures, you see basically the same liquid correlations of the RVB point. On the other side, we're looking now at to the right of the RK point into the crystal phase, because we would like to make sure that we see the crystal when it's there. At the lowest temperatures, you see this huge peak, which is now, this thing has been divided by a factor of 10 to make it fit on the same curve. So this is that. This huge peak is evidence that of this staggered state. And then as I raise the temperature at the same point, I go back basically to these classical correlations. Now that's 0 to pi. This is, you know, 0 to pi that way. And you can see that the crosses are again the classical result. So as you raise the temperature, you go back to the classical phase. So it's really a very short-range phase, which is why it's efficient to find it by Monte Carlo. So unless, you know, modulo the question of our algorithm being kooky, which in Monte Carlo you always have to fret that you haven't. I don't off the bat remember, they're fairly big, but I can give you the numbers. I wasn't carrying the paper with me, so I can't. The right side are all at V over T of 1.08, which is to the right of the Roxar-Kivelson point, plotted at different temperatures. Left is pretty much the same low temperature, moving to the leftwards from the RK point. Okay. Spin-ons. As we go to infinite temperature, I genuinely meant to compliment Fisher and Stevenson's work, because even with these Pfaffian techniques, the question of calculating the free energy of two monomers is not a trivial exercise. And we have not, to this point, carried it out. We encourage anybody who'd like to do so. Intuitively, I think it's clear that if algebraic correlations gave you a logarithmic confinement, then exponential correlations are probably not going to give you confinement at all. What we did do was study a few ladders and convinced ourselves that the trend was strongly consistent with the fact that in the thermodynamic limit, two monomers at infinite temperature will feel no long-range confinement. Again, at the RK point, you can write down exact states, so there's no confinement at that point. But now, since we have a phase to the left, it seems entirely reasonable to imagine that the confinement properties throughout that phase are the same, and that spin-ons are therefore deconfined throughout this phase. Okay, so those, I think, were the chief results on the problem itself. So I want to do two things. One is I want to get to this business about gauge theories in connection to work done here. I should mention that there's, of course, other sightings, if you will, of the of such an RBB state in the triangular lattice. There's work by Claire Lullier's group, numerical studies of Heisenberg magnets with sort of two-spin and four-spin exchange couplings, in which they've seen evidence for what looks like a spin liquid. Back in 92, Subir Sachdev, as he was plowing through the available list of lattices with SPN, noted that noted that on the triangular lattice, in fact, there was a stable disordered phase. So the way the SPN, I guess, is basically Schwinger boson mean field theory, except you know the ordered phase can now be treated in this fashion. That there's a disordered phase that you can get in SPN equals infinity at what correspond to small values as a spin, and when you do, you get spin 1/2 excitations. Now again, in that language, you get a unique disordered ground state. It's not clear that that's RVB, because you don't have this notion of resonance. Roderick ran into Subir, who assured him that the ground state there was also fourfold degenerate, result that presumably Subir knows, although it's not in the published paper. That would then suggest that in some sense, the fourfold degeneracy I've come to, which we have, they may indeed be the same state, although again, n equals infinity is n equals infinity. But maybe as a Schwinger boson mean field theory, one can make sense somehow of the connection. I should mention one experiment recently. There's a preprint by Caldea et al., Oak Ridge, Oxford collaboration, neutron scattering on, I think it's cesium, copper, chloride, or something, which is a triangular lattice, although with anisotropic couplings. They've got strong couplings in one direction and sort of weaker couplings elsewhere. And they've argued, based on their analysis of the spin 1 scattering spectrum, that in fact it's not explained just by doing spin wave theory, and that you have to invoke the notion of fractionalized spin-ons in order to understand the width of the spectrum.
Is it loaded
antiferromagnets? At the very lowest temperatures, yes, but they're working above a putative transition. It's a three-dimensional thing ultimately, so there's some very low temperature ordering, but above that. Yes, I can indeed. One reason they estimate parameters for it, so the ratio, I think this is about 40% of that coupling. There's a series expansion study by, I think, Rajiv Singh, collaborators, which had studied such anisotropic triangular lattices. And as a function of an anisotropy parameter, this is the isotropic point, which is, of course, nail ordered. And then this is, let's say, 1D chains where this coupling is gone altogether. So what they found was that the nail state gives way rather quickly. After that, you actually find a columnar valence bond phase. This is my evidence for saying that even in the triangular lattice, you ought to be able to get into valence bond dominated phases. They do dimer expansions. After that, they get something that they don't understand. The expansions fail, suggestive either that it's a liquid or perhaps it's got, they suggest, spiral order or whatever. And the experiments do seem to lie in this range. So I think that's a nice thing to focus on, to see if one can, in particular, if it's some sort of anisotropic version of this liquid state, that would be very nice, because we would finally have found that. But anyway, I commend to all of you that you examine that particular preprint. Good. Ising gauge theories.
Before that, George, the two transition points, do you know where they are, continuous or just...
Oh, okay, here, sorry, yeah. If this state is ordered, we have a conjecture which is connected to some of the things I'm going to say. This is first order in the sense that the ground state, you know, changes discontinuously. We have a conjecture for that, which is that there's a transverse field Ising model and the honeycomb lattice, which, since we're not sure about the order on the other side, so I take it with some grains of salt, which has, we think, an O4 transition based on a symmetry analysis. But then if you project it onto the dimer manifold, that should describe this. So it would be somehow, if that works, that's a spin-on-confinement transition represented by a transverse fluidizing model, but with a projection, which is not necessarily what these gentlemen would.
But numerically, you cannot tell whether it's algebraic. Or
we have not actually tried to look at that. I mean, the data I showed you is that. You know, it barely begins to develop. The state has a very large unit cell. So we can't, we're not even sure that the state exists, and we can't go to big enough system sizes to actually attempt to do that directly. Let me just leave it at that. Okay. So in the last part, I just want to make this connection to gauge theories. Again, Roberto Fradkin and Steve Kivelson did this in a U1 language a long time back. I want to do it in an Ising language, motivated by the fact that we came to this problem through an Ising model. Think for a moment of the fully frustrated Ising model on the square lattice. This is the simplest way to draw pictures. So what I do is I take a square lattice, and I make every other row of bonds antiferromagnetic. At this point, every plaquette has the property that it has one antiferromagnetic bond and three ferromagnetic, so if I go plus, 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 I'm in trouble because that bond is frustrated. So this model is frustrated. Ground states are obtained by putting exactly one bad bond per plaquette. So let me, in fact, for simplicity, represent as bad bonds by these curly things would go, I'm just putting them on the antiferromagnetic bonds. That's just a gauge choice. It doesn't really matter where I put them. This is a ground state, because I have to put at least one bad bond per plaquette, and but no more than that would be a ground state. There's something geometrical about this that one can usefully use. If I go to the dual lattice, which is also square in this case, and draw in dimers every time I see a bad bond, I will get a dimer covering of the dual lattice, because I will connect this to exactly one site, and I must connect it to one, and that's a hardcore dimer covering. So ground states of the fully frustrated Ising model in the square lattice they're also dimer coverings of the square lattice.
Is that true for the other gauge equivalent?
Yeah, because this is a statement of which bond is bad. That's a gauge invariant statement, because that's SJS. S, right? So that's...
Yeah, which is high energy, right? Yeah. By bad, you mean which is high
energy. Which is high energy. That's right. Exactly. So that's sort of phi e to the I, which is a phi sort of object. Now, if I take the fully frustrated Ising model, which has some Hamiltonian, which is Jij, Siz, Sjz, and I add to it the simplest quantum dynamics, which is the sort of stuff Roderick and I were studying, which is that of a transverse field, and the transverse field likes to flip spins. Now, if the transverse field is small, it would like to flip those spins which are consistent with the ground state constraint. Those spins in the transverse field language are flippable. So this is an example of a flippable spin, because it's got two good and two bad bonds, and I can flip it. But flipping that spin is actually exactly equivalent to rotating the dimer pair. It's a resonance move in the dimer language, right? Well, I'm running out of things to draw. So the transverse field Ising model in the limit of small transverse fields is exactly the quantum dimer model with just the kinetic energy term. I can add to the transverse field Ising model other terms, which will represent the other terms in the dimer model. But the Hilbert space equality means that these are really the same problem. So actually, we realized this by ourselves a couple years back, that there was this connection to dimer models. And therefore, although we were studying transverse field Ising models because they seem to be the simplest models of quantum frustration, a frustrated magnet with quantum dynamics, we discovered to our delight that they seem to be also of relevance to antiferromagnetic phase, you know, models with valence bond phases, which would then be described by quantum dimer models. So at one level, this is one way to make a direct geometrical connection between why you might expect a transverse field Ising model to show up if you're studying a Heisenberg antiferromagnet, even though the symmetries of the problem, of course, are different the way they're formulated.
This is only for the transverse field small?
When the transverse field small. But I can add other terms which will move me along that axis, but it will always be, because I will want to respect the ground state constraint. That's what makes the Hilbert space connection possible. Now, if I take the dual of this 2 plus 1 dimensional transverse field Ising model, I will get a gauge theory. In three dimensions, duals of Ising models, you know, duals of bond interactions are Plaquette interactions, and so this is in fact an Ising-Gage theory. If I wanted to go to one dimension more and try and play this trick, I'd have to actually do something more complicated. In 3 plus 1, I would have to imagine that I have some cube like that. I'll pick Plaquette variables, right? I mean, so I'll take products around Plaquettes of spins, and then I'll give them some coefficient k sub p, and I'll pick the k sub p so that, let's say, you know, 5 of them have to be ferromagnetic and 1 has to be antiferromagnetic. If I do that, I'll have 1 bad Plaquette, and then, of course, I'll be able to draw a valence bond. So in a dimension more, I'll have to write a two-form gauge theory to be able to describe a Dimer model. But note that the dual of the two-form gauge theory is, again, an Ising-Gage theory. And in fact, you can convince yourself that any dimension you go to, this trick will always give you an Ising-Gage theory when you take its dual. At which point, even those of us who are not so bright sort of begin to see that there's an Ising-Gage theory. And then, of course, you realize that since what you're doing is something pretty stupid, if this is the valence bond you want to describe, you first go to the dual lattice and then you take its dual, you might as well go back to the direct lattice and formulate it directly. And how do you do that? So on the square lattice, you imagine that there is, on each link, an Ising variable, so whose eigenvalues denoted by sigma x can be plus or minus 1. Imagine, so now consider valence bond configurations. Here's a valence bond and 3 of them are absent. I'll call that plus 1, call these guys minus 1. So I have a Hilbert space labeled by Ising variables that live in the links, but then I have a constraint. So let me write down a constraint operator. Let's say this site is x, which is sum over all links that belong to x, so the neighboring links. And then I have an operator of whose eigenvalues these are, and this is going to be my constraint operator. And the statement has to be that physical states are those for which the constraint operator gives me minus 2 times the physical state, because 3 minus 1s and a plus 1 add up to minus 2. Okay. So I need this constraint. What's my Hamiltonian in this language? I'll just write it very schematically. I've got minus t times the sum over Plaquettes. What I have to do on a Plaquette, it turns out, is write sigma plus, sigma minus, sigma plus, sigma minus as I go around the Plaquette and its Hermitian conjugate. And then I have this potential energy term, which I'm going to write as sigma x on these bonds and nothing on this, plus the sigma x on these bonds, right, and nothing on that.
So plus here is sigma z plus I sigma.
That's right.
Y.
It's a raising operator for sigma x, so sigma plus exactly as you said is sigma z plus I sigma y, or maybe
why
sigma.
Why just call it sigma z?
Because the way you normally do it is your resonance term will have sigma z, right? You'd write sigma z in the transverse field of sigma x, just to make contact with John Kogut's review if you happen to be looking at it. But I could
just choose sigma z here.
I can do it there. Right. Actually, if I wanted to be perverse, I'd probably also use lowercase Hebrew.
No, I think the point is that instead of just writing sigma plus sigma minus sigma plus sigma minus.
Oh, why not read sigma? No, this is important. Sorry. Oh, I'm sorry. Is that what you're asking me? That's an excellent point. A very important point. Why am I not writing just sigma z? The reason I'm not writing sigma z is that if I write sigma z's, then this constraint will not commute with the Hamiltonian. It will take things which involve, it will flip everybody. So it may act on a Plaquette, for instance, let's say I had this one, right, and this one, it will act on this Plaquette, make flip that, get rid of this one, but create 3 dimers, which will no longer satisfy the constraint, hardcore constraint. So, I was just about to make that point, but this is a crucial point. To do it this way, I actually can't use the standard sigma z term, because that will not commute with the constraint that I wish to impose, which is this one.
You can make a constraint that was an odd number.
Yes, exactly. Then I can. So, right.
And put a transverse field.
Yes.
And then put a transverse field, which favors only having one.
Yeah, but there's a crucial symmetry difference, which is something to
those,
I want.
Those
yeah.
are very quick step. Is it the original lattice or the dual lattice?
This is now the original lattice. I'm doing it directly on the original lattice. Where there's a valence bond, I put a
you
plus
started
1.
With the first state passing model.
Right.
So those are the same bonds.
No,
this is now these valence bonds. Yeah. So I went through this logic that I could start, do Ising model on the dual, then dual that, but that means I might as well work in the original lattice. So I'm now directly formulating on the lattice of valence bonds a theory which will be a gauge theory. Okay. This is what I have to write down, and with this it's true that the Hamiltonian commutes with each of the local constraints.
I'm sorry, I didn't get the constraint. At each site you have four things coming out.
Right.
Four bonds.
Right.
So and they have the sum of the sigma x, the constraint says that the, it has
minus
to be
two.
Minus 2. So right. The 2 plus and 2 minus, that would not work.
No.
Three
minuses
and 1 plus. Okay.
Right. Right.
So that's what is required.
That's what is required if okay. Hardcore dimers is what you're trying to achieve. So this then is true, and this means that this is a gauge theory. Okay. Now, whether in space-time you want to add other things is up to you. At the Hamiltonian level, you know, this is sort of as close as. In particular, if you took the standard Eisengage theory, which was the point that these two gentlemen were just alluding to, this would sort of be sum over plaquettes of just sigma z, sigma z, sigma z, sigma z, and then you wouldn't have that, but you might have a term which was linear, which was sigma x. And that would be a transverse field, and this would be some coupling like that. And that would be then. And that would have a local constraint, which would not be this one. But for that, the local constraint, so compare the standard constraint, which is actually an integrated form of this constraint. This is like a differential constraint. If you exponentiate it, product of sigma x acting on the physical state is plus 1 if you're doing the standardizing gauge theory that everybody loves. But if you dualize the transverse fieldizing model, you get minus 1 acting on physical states, which is to say you can have either 1 or 3 dimers coming out of each site.
So the transverse field is the code.
You take gamma much bigger than k, or whatever.
No, this is just a statement about Hilbert spaces. The constraint would allow you locally. If I work in the sigma x representation, I just work in the sigma x representation, and I just label states by what their sigma x eigenvalues are, and then I can take superpositions to get any state I want. The local constraint will be that in the sigma x representation, I have either 1 dimer or 3.
You're just suggesting that you don't treat it all as a constraint. You have a constraint that gets you part of the way there, and then you put a big term in your Hamiltonian to get the rest.
Fine. I could. What I'm confused about, and this is something I'd like to discuss with you two gentlemen at least, is if I write it this way, this theory actually has a U1 invariance. Although it's formulated in an Ising-Hilbert space, since this is the linear constraint, all transformations U of alpha, e to the I alpha of x, c of x, actually commute with the Hamiltonian. And that looks like a U1 gauge theory. Although it's a peculiar U1 gauge theory, it actually doesn't have the full Hilbert space of a U1 gauge theory, which would be an integer-valued variable in each link that ran from minus infinity to plus infinity. But it does seem to have this. I was actually rather surprised by this, but in this projected limit of the Ising model, the Ising-Gauge theory apparently also has this U1. Okay. Whether
the number of dimers coming out of each
is conserved, right. Okay. So whether this is important or not, I think.
Yeah, so I mean, what we've been doing is saying the number of dimers that come out of each site
is odd. Right.
And then we just determine the Hamiltonian,
right.
Which
right.
Strongly favors right. One coming out rather than right. Three. And so at low energies,
I see.
It's the same physics.
But now the question is the U1 important at low energies?
Not, right? Because at low energies.
So the square lattice for this model is presumably important because you always get confinement and so on.
Well, but you always get confinement in the Z2.
As formulated, it has a U1 gauge theory character, and on the triangular lattice, it's a U1 gauge theory with deconfinement. It is a U1 gauge theory. It is deconfined. So at least the notion that any U1 gauge theory that you write down can't be true, although maybe, you know, so this, you have to somehow decide.
With matter, U1 gauge theory.
No, there's no matter here. This is just the pure gauge theory. There's no matter yet.
There's no matter.
This is a statement about a pure gauge theory.
No, but on the other hand, if you... Basically, you have spin loss variation.
What?
I mean, you have this Ising variation.
Right.
And you have this quantum dynamics.
Right.
If you go to some kind of slave boson representation and try to write down... Then it will turn out to be some kind of gauge field coupled to matter.
Okay. Look. No, maybe. There's another way of doing it. You can think of the triangular lattice as a square lattice with some crossings put in. And if you do it this way, you can then say to yourself something similar, which is I really have a U1 gauge theory to which I've added a charge to Higgs scalar, and therefore. So maybe you can rationalize it that way. I just want to make the point that it can be formulated as a U1 gauge theory, which seems a natural formulation, although with this peculiarizing nature of the Hilbert space, and it still has deconfinement. Okay. The next thing I want to say probably is going to be even worse, which is the last thing I have to say. So, if you ask the question, how many ground states do I have in the liquid phase, what I can tell you is that at this point, we have four. Okay. This follows from an analysis just of dimer states on a torus, and this is goes back to Thales, although again we had to rediscover it for ourselves, not realizing it was there. So basically the idea is you take a curve through your system, imagine it's on a torus and you're sort of going around some way, and you ask how many dimers sort of are crossing it, is the number even or odd? The dynamics of the system will flip two of them at once and will actually conserve that, right, because it'll only change it by two. And in fact, if you have odd numbers of dimers, that generalizes. And there's a way of doing it in terms of transition graphs and so on, but let's leave that aside. So it's there's an Ising variable, you know, is it odd or even? And then you have two of those, so you have four ground states on the torus. So at this point, we know that there are four zero energy states. Presumably, that's true in here, that their energies are really degenerate, or exponentially degenerate in system size or something, although technically we haven't shown that. So let's assume that that's true. So in that sense, this has the requirements for topological order. That degeneracy is then of that origin. Now, let's ask what happens when we dope this system. So in the dimer model language, when you dope, you're going to do something like this. So if I have some triangle in which I have a dimer, I'll put a monomer somewhere, and then I'll have a move in which this thing moves. Let's say he ends up there, and the dimer ends up there. Right? So in the dimer language, this is the natural thing to write. In the gauge theory language, what I will do is I'll put an Ising variable at each site, which will be the matter field. Then I'll have a raising operator for that and a lowering operator for that, and I'll do something like, you know, for instance, destroy that one, you know, and create that one here, and destroy that dimer and create that dimer. So it'll look like something like tau plus, sigma minus, tau minus, if the taus are the matter and the sigmas are the gauge fields. Okay. Never mind. It will look like what you think it ought to look like, matter, string of gauge things in between.
Do you want electron matter?
Sorry? These are holes.
So yeah, holons.
Holons.
Are they bosons?
Let's leave all of that aside, because what they are is all I can tell you is what Steve said in his papers, namely that there's, you know, he wrote down also what you termed the Wison and the question of whether it binds or not and so on. Naively, there seem to be bosons, there can be fermions. That seems to be a matter of detail. But the point I want to make is the following. You can ask the following question. If I'm allowed to put in, let's say, two holes and I move them around, what happens to the topology? And the answer is, these four disconnected sectors that I had in the torus, which are really disconnected in the dimer model, are now connected. By moving the holes around, I can actually get from one sector to the other. Which means that if these holes are in a deconfined phase and running around, it looks like what you will do is in fact select a unique state once you've doped and lose the topological degeneracy. Okay. Now,
how does this kind of what are the excitations
If they're localized, then you're probably fine.
Oh, okay.
So, but the important point is we're looking in a spin chart separated phase where by assumption these guys are free to move around. And if they're free to move around,
No, they're bosons and
they're
free to move around.
They're
superconnected.
Yeah.
So you're
going into a superconnected
phase. Okay. Okay. Maybe
that's
the way to
describe
what
you're.
Okay. Then it's a pretty complicated.
Okay. But the statement I'm making is all kinematic. I'm simply noting that if they're free to move around, and I suspect it makes no difference to me whether they're fermions or bosons. So we can let that. Well, but it's a question of whether they can get to far away configurations. That's a question of confinement, not really a question of statistics. And it seems to me that in that case, I will end up. But if you can convince me otherwise, I'd be delighted. Okay. That would then, because this is a concrete realization of some of the things you've been saying, and we can discuss that further. So this is potentially a lesson for me. Now, there's one way to square the circle as far as this and proofs of topological order and Ising gauge theories are concerned, which is the last thing I have to say, and then I will cease taxing your patience. So in the standard Ising gauge theory language, there's the celebrated two-parameter phase diagram written down by Kratkin and Schenker. So you have some K term, which is the gauge coupling, and J is, you know, S, sigma S, and this is sort of sigma, 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 very schematically. And the point they made was that for the standard case, you had perhaps a free, you know, a deconfined phase here. This was confined, 0 and infinity. This is Higgs. And this is then a sort of a paramagnet as far as the spins are concerned, which is also the deconfined phase. If you're doing it as quantum Hamiltonians, then you have this guy is the gauge action. But in addition, you have a term that looks like J times sort of, if you like, S sigma S. And then you can have a term that looks like gamma times Sx. This is Sz, sigma z, Sz. Okay? That's what you want to write down. Now, this point down here in the pure gauge theory is fourfold degenerate. And what you have to convince yourself is that as you perturb, you don't lose that degeneracy. In this language, this is fine. This has a fourfold degeneracy because that limit corresponds to having k equals infinity. Basically, there's no gamma. Now I add to it matter. If matter is added in a way that the coupling is weak, but there's a finite transverse field present, then before I start doing coupling, the matter is in a unique ground state. So the fourfold degeneracy of the gauge sector survives. Then I do perturbation theory in this, and it's easy to convince yourself that on a cylinder, for instance, you have to go all the way around the cylinder before you can undo it. But crucial in that was the fact that this gave me a unique state. In the dimer model, I'm sort of adding a term that looks like that, but I don't really seem to have a term that looks like that.
So that's the differential between the holon thing.
Okay.
It's something that gaps the holon.
Well, it's a one holon thing, which somehow, this is where the U1 part also comes in, because you're able to get away with it because you're doing Eisen things where flipping them doesn't seem to matter.
Sc up is a holon there, and Sc down is not.
Right. Sc is a holon creation operator, is what I think. Yeah, right.
In which case, there's a differential between the holon.
The way I look at it literally is that you're able to get away with having things created and destroyed because they're sort of Ising charge. But maybe I'm not.
Sz is a holon creation operator, or
Sx
is a holon density. So this is a chemical potential term.
Right. Well, okay, maybe. Yeah.
But if you're half filling, so it's insulated, it'd be a propulsion.
I'm not sure because the mapping to what I've been saying is not direct. So if this is their interpretation of it, then that rules. The point I just want to make is that I don't know how to write an analog of this term directly for what I'm doing, because I tend to end up writing S pluses, sigma pluses, things like that. And I don't seem to have a term that gives me, in the absence of hopping, a unique ground state for the holes, is what I want to say. And that seems to me to be the problem.
Presumably it was an insulating state.
Yeah, so a Coulomb interaction
between the holes. Exactly. You could crystallize the
holes. All right. If you could do that, but then of course in a liquid phase I would, and so on and so forth, I wouldn't. So if everything is fine, that's great, because then you have a very concrete way of thinking about some of these things. That leaves aside, of course, the question of whether the Ising gauge theories that you've been doing, they clearly seem to have been very intimately connected to the physics of a valence bond state. It also nicely connects to your general ideology, which then goes back to this other work of Kivelson and Rockshire, the business about the fact that in a superconductor, you can screen the charge of a quasi-particle by using the condensate. One thing that always puzzled me when you started doing this was, how could I do this in an insulator? But of course, in an insulator of valence bonds, I can use the valence bonds, as it were, to screen the charge and leave me only with a spin-on. So in some sense, going between a superconductor where you screen the charge of the spin-on and a valence bond phase where you screen the charge of the spin-on seems to be something that you can do continuously, presumably, as you've discussed, by having parameters that change the amount of charge fluctuation that you can have. But in the strongly correlated limit, it seems to me that the valence bond physics is somehow up to this U1 question that I don't entirely understand is the Ising gauge theory version of deconfinement. But I'll leave it at that.